Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my gun.
Took it in the guts, Barry.
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
did you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
The glass is made of yards of highly chased.
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Showreel, and today we've got an excellent film to talk to you about. It's called Iron Winter, and I'll leave the discussion to tell you most about the film. I won't even carry on, really. It's about a subject that's pretty extraordinary. I talked to Casimir Burgess, who is the writer director of the film. It's a documentary, and it's set in the Sakhir Valley, which is in Mongolia. So of course, Casimir is Australian, so it's a kind of a really quite a left-field sort of a thing for an Australian filmmaker and his crew to be involved in. So let's get on with what he had to say about it.
Iron Winter is a fabulously interesting film, and, of course, it's set on the steppes of Mongolia, basically. How did this come about, Casimir?
There was an article that Edward Cavanagh wrote in Al Jazeera about a herding community there that was sort of, suffering. They had traditions that were under threat due to climate change and modernization, globalization. But there was a few families that were talking about bringing this tradition of taking 2,000 horses through the Sakhir over winter, 5-month trip at altitude at minus 50. Bringing that tradition back. And I thought, I'll head over there with the producers and see if there's a hunger or an appetite for this story to be told.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about the timeline of production versus the real world timeline. How did that correlate?
So we were there, we went for a recce, and there was a lot of love for the idea. I think they really wanted this tradition, this pathway to manhood for their young boys captured. So things moved pretty quick after that 3-week recce. We came back for, a 5-week shoot, and then we left them and then came back for 7-week shoot. So we weren't there for the full 5 months, although I think you get a really good sense of the resilience and the time and the difficulty of that very long, dark winter.
You got funding from Screen Australia, MIF, Premier Fund and Vic Screen. So how did that come about?
Look, Chris Kamen, Ben Galotta, Morgan Wright, our Australian producers are very good at, have great relationships with the agencies, with MIF and TV, etc. So they cobbled it together, and it was all time critical because the herders were going to go, and we needed to be there. So yeah. I think there was some good momentum just because of that. It was either we're going to be there or not, and possibly the last winter herd after many hundreds of years of this tradition. It was now or never. So we got over there and had an incredible time, but a very difficult time and many near-death. It felt like many near-death moments, particularly at minus 50, when you've bogged your car, it's midnight, and you're with your Mongolian producer, who thankfully has incredible understanding of the landscape and can read stars and get you back to base camp.
It's a mind-blowing story, really, isn't it? I mean, because
Yeah.
you center it on the two young fellows and the broader community that they're part of. It's all about pacing and personality, isn't it? As well as environment.
Yeah, I guess the pacing, it's that sort of slow dread of a really long winter. Hopefully there's joy in this film too, I think, through the friendship. There's lots of laughs, but you're right, the pacing, there's something about time and resilience. And what we experienced in Mongolia was that yeah, the Mongolians had a different connection to time. It was like, oh, okay, I'll see you in a couple of hours, and that might be a couple of days. So we had to really just relax into that approach and fall under the spell of the landscape and the culture, and really change our more rigid ways of thinking to get the film made. You throw all your Excel spreadsheets out the window, and fuel reports and this and that. They're just kind of going on intuition and dancing with the storm, as they call it, which is very beautiful in a way. But takes a lot for our more Western approach to adapt to.
That's part of the film for us as an audience. That's what we're experiencing as well.
Yeah, I think so. Just letting the power of the landscape and the landscape of the faces as well just sort of play out, rather than trying to run in there, run and gun with lots of different, sort of camera moves, was not the approach for this. We kind of lock things off in a more tableau cinematic way with beautiful old 100-year-old lenses, and let things play out in a more natural, controlled way. It just felt respectful to, well, both our subjects, but also the incredible landscape. And yeah, the film recently won one of the highest accolades for cinematography in the world. Benjamin Bryan, our cinematographer, was awarded in Poland. So I think that approach is really something worth seeing on the big screen, if you can find this film. And I think you can fall under the spell of the Mongolian landscape in winter. It's very austere, but there's good action in this film to kind of get you through some of that austerity.
If you look at the way the framing is, like that beautiful shot where they're sitting in the doorway of the Ger.
Yes, that's a 400-year-old Ger, handed down through generations. But Vult and Sagana, our heroes, their fathers used that when they were their age, and their fathers before them, and so on. So it's incredible sacred space in a way. And each notch and each bit of fabric and all of the layering, there's so much story and texture and history in those possessions that are used for journey and survival.
This is part of what the film is contributing to us, a realization of how things are done, but also that these people are not separate from the modern world. I mean, like the boys said, I miss Facebook and chatting with the girls.
Yes. Yeah, no, they're sort of caught between two worlds, aren't they? That was part of what attracted me to the story. It just seems so urgent. This is the last few herders, the last generation really of nomad herders, and a last ditch effort to keep this 1,000-year-old tradition alive. But the boys are, they're also, like all of us, addicted to social media and their phones. And there was a period there of digital detox, as there was for all of us, being so remote. We were 10 hours from the nearest town that barely had internet, and then 10 hours from that tiny town to, without any hospital or anything, if something happened to us, to the nearest, well, to Ulaanbaatar, the capital. So many, many hours away from civilization, and yet we've all been modernized to some degree, and hunger for that, all of those technologies.
It's kind of interesting, this film, on a whole lot of levels. Minimal conversation, and it's in translation. It's almost like animal tracks along a path, these conversations, and they're full of very important and big stories. So, for example, the track around the love and connection to the horses, That was so lovely, the way they relate to the horses and the conversations that they had in relation to humanness and horses and reincarnation. So therefore we get this cosmology as well as fixedness to the earth.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we were incredibly enchanted or inspired by over there was the Mongolian connection to landscape and to the horses, of course. The horses are like gods to Mongolians. They're their most valuable, well, I don't want to say possession, but there's this beautiful symbiotic connection between humans and horses in Mong well, it may be around the world, but particularly in Mongolia, where they first domesticated horses and have built up such an incredible understanding of the horse and what it needs. But I feel like what you're watching there or appreciating is, yeah, the level of skill they have around horse riding, but also the level of curiosity and sort of reverence they have. And also a naivety around, as you say, the process of reincarnation. Like, will they end up as a horse? Would a horse become a human? You know, they're very kind of
And
these
where are
boys just,
they? And where are they now?
where do we go? So I think it's beautiful the way these boys sort of unpack the human condition, and they have all the questions that we all do. They don't have any answers necessarily, but they do have a kind of faith in the landscape, in nature, in all the spirits that they can feel and see in Mongolian, well, particularly, I guess, in these communities. They learn to read the landscape very intimately, as herders. They have to for weather and the next day. What's it going to look like? What's our next move? It's getting harder for them, and we observed that as well, to read weather. The weather is up and down. So there's a kind of climate grief, which I noticed, particularly as, you know, some of their horses start to die from inability to reach pasture.
We're blessed to actually meet these boys and to know about a world that we just imagine. I mean, I can't even imagine living in a place that's 50 degrees below. I mean, it's just a hideous concept to me. But and the fact that humans are able to actually survive is miraculous in itself.
Yes. And the reason they do survive is that sacred choreography with the seasons. So it's what we're talking about here is that respect for Mother Nature, and they will just move accordingly to their summer camp, to their winter shelter and autumn, spring. They're just responding to it and dancing with the seasons, which I found very poignant, very beautiful. If only we could all react so delicately to Mother Nature.
The conversation about nomadism versus sedentary and the connection to modernity is actually sh a shadow in this film. The shadow of modernity that undermines human connection to the natural world.
Yeah, as Uncle Zhizhere says in the story before he leaves the boys, the stationary ones are doing better. The nomads are suffering. The world's just being built around those very static cities now, isn't it? And the nomads are losing their connection because all the work is in the big cities.
Oh, but also the role of Mongolia as a source of rare earths. You don't go into this, but obviously its usefulness in the modern world has changed the role of the people and their connection to their country, as it were.
Yes.
But the story of their relative who worked in the abattoir was, it was like a modern horror film,
Yeah.
his
As he
story.
says, imagine killing the thing you love the most. I find Zhizhere is a beautiful character, and it felt like he was something out of a sort of an old Western. There was something kind of fatalistic about his journey and tragic and foreshadowing, maybe for the boys, you know, if they didn't make a change in their life, they could end up that way too.
My name is Gerald Dwyer, the actor, and I played the lead in a film in What About Sal? You are listening to 3CR.
You are listening to 3CR and you're listening to Showreel and a conversation I had with filmmaker Casimir Burgess. His film is Iron Winter and it's set in the steppes of Mongolia. It's the Zashkia Valley. He goes on to talk about more things, but the standout in that first part for me was climate grief, the concept of climate grief. It's one of the reasons for why this film is such a revelation and a fascinating film for all people to listen and watch.
If we go back to the making of the film, you said it was a 5-week shoot.
So winter was 5 months and then we filmed over two separate shoots. One of them was 5 weeks, I think, and the other one was 8 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Tell me the special challenges. I mean, because obviously there must have been challenges.
Yeah. Just finding the herders the second time round. So when we filmed them in autumn, to start with, that was fine. We were there with them and they were closer to town. But coming back and trying to find them in the dead of winter, once we got to base camp, which is a long way from anywhere, using 80 series land cruisers and following this 1920s Russian missile carrier, which was dragging a 2-meter tire behind it just to create a little bit of road for us. Even that was a nightmare. We got bogged in very, very deep snow, probably every half an hour, and the whole team, 12 of us, would get out and dig the vehicles out and just keep moving. But yeah, when we got and set up base camp, we thought, great, we'll see the herders tomorrow. It's going to be wonderful to be reunited because we'd become mates, and it seemed so exciting to be back with them. But we couldn't get over a pass, and this is a pass that's, you know, probably 4,500 meters. So the air's very, very thin. But beyond that, you have very steep slopes, and we kept sliding backwards and, you know, nearly rolling cars and things like this. And it took us a week to find a way, which ended up being just pulling the cars up by hand, using, you know, just kind of pulley ropes and straps that we kind of tied together. We managed to eventually, like a Fitzcarraldo kind of story, pull those cars up and celebrate with vodka at the top of the hill. But it was very, you know, for producers as well. It's like you're spending quite a lot of money each day. We're running out of fuel. We're running out of food. And I just felt like, you know, we didn't have a film. We weren't going to get to them. But eventually we made it. And the film begun, but it was very touch and go on so many different occasions, particularly, running out of food for, like, once we were staying with the herders in a small splinter group, we came very low on supplies because we couldn't get top-ups from our main base because the weather was so bad. So we ourselves started eating horse meat. And there was enough of that because the horses kept dying over Mongolia's harshest winter on record. But it, you know, it didn't sit that well with our bodies, very rich meat. But yeah, thankfully the herders, they looked after us. And perhaps that's not the most professional relationship with your subject for them to be giving us their meat. But there was enough to go around and they enjoyed sharing different recipes and things with us. So yeah, look, it became really intimate and it wasn't easy, but it was one of the best experiences of my life. Very bonding.
And of course you survived, so that's an added bonus.
They were concerned our noses would fall off because pointy Western noses, that was the biggest concern, and I still have my nose.
yeah. What about the editing? Tell me about that. Because it's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. But you actually don't dwell on that hardship that you obviously really closely experienced.
Yeah, we don't. I guess we don't tell our story. Although we filmed a lot of what we were going through, it didn't feel right on balance with the herder's story. They're quite stoic and resilient and brave and all those things. And we were more vulnerable. And so our story in the edit kind of just overshadowed somehow in some strange way the herder's story and the Mongolian story and their plight. You know, our story, it's interesting to talk about, but I think people are more interested in this 2,000-year-old tradition and the last family and their attempt to survive over winter, to keep culture alive and to keep thousands of horses that belong to their community alive and find that pasture and get home alive. The edit was very long. Was it 9 months or something like that? And I was by myself for probably 8 months of that. I had some help from Kenny Ang at the very end, who he cut the horse competition scene, did a beautiful job on that. There were so many cameras, it was quite a technical edit. So I really appreciate his help on that. But more of, I guess, the emotional, the subtle sort of scenes between the two herders, Butvolt and Sagana, the two boys, the older boy and the slightly younger boy, and then the uncle Zhizhere and the father Bayanhunger. I kind of needed to feel that out myself and work out the dynamics of the group. A huge translation job, as you can imagine, as well. So that was being fed to me as I edit. We had probably 12 different translators doing sections of the rushes. Because they don't, obviously, they're not just doing the hour and a half film. They're looking at probably 200, 300 hours of footage.
Amazing.
And that's a tricky one as well, because you go back and forth to the community and get, oh, it doesn't mean this, it's actually this. You know, there's different dialects and, you know, farming language as opposed to city language. So finding the right words it was important to us that that was done properly and that there were many passes on that to make sure it was accurate. Yeah, they're very poetic souls, and as we spoke about before, their connection to the mountains, the mother ma it's not just a mountain, say, it's a mother mountain, that's a feeder mountain that will give them life, and each stone, each river, each tree. Is imbued with that magic. So we kind of fell under that spell as well, which helps, you know, in a kind of cinematic language. You want to fall under the spell of the landscapes, don't you?
Yeah, you do. That's right. And also the music. The music's fantastic.
Yeah, Luke Altman, my only direction to him was, can we not use derivative sounds, or, you know, like, can we not use a violin or cello or piano? Let's use something that is more unusual and can integrate more into such a visceral, primal landscape. A sound, or a score rather, a soundscape that maybe sounds more like thunder or a rock falling, an echo, something from kind of that's haunting from underneath. And that's quite a vague direction, but he's like, yeah, I think I've got the instrument. So he and his friend went away and they built this music box, which is like something between sort of analog and synth. It's a wild looking thing with lots of buttons on it and a single string and a Mongolian horsehair bow that you could play sounds on, and you have to record it as you go because the sounds will never repeat. So if you record enough of those unusual sounds, then you can build a kind of vocabulary, like a palette of sounds that then you can build a score from.
Oh, that's
So
fantastic, because it felt like breathing. I mean, and it also explained a little bit about, in my mind, a bit about Tibetan throat singing. You know what I mean? Like it had that kind of, I've always wondered about how that came about, you know, because it's a meditative approach, but it's the variations and movement in the sounds. Ah, fantastic stuff.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'll pass that on to Luke. But yeah, it was a very long, slow process. And then to marry that music with sound design was a lot of fun. And Simon and Pippet at Windmill did incredible detailed sound design work in the footsteps of the horses and every breath, as you say, and piece of wind, working as much as possible with what we'd recorded, but also introducing lots of flourishes that we'd recorded over there. So they're all sometimes elevated for drama, because as you say, there's not a huge amount of dialogue, but it's hopefully it's quite an immersive experience because of the work that's gone into the cinematography and the sound design and the score and all the things.
Oh yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, it's not a boring moment. It's not a boring film at all. Tell me, have the boys and their families seen the film?
Yes, yeah. They came to Ulaanbaatar and had their red carpet moment. The film travelled to many, many, many different countries last year and won lots of awards. And every time the film screens somewhere or gets an award, the boys are all over it. They're very good on the internet and social medias and very proud of their involvement. And also, yeah, the film was presented in the town in which they're from, that very remote Sakya town. And it was screened for many days in a town hall, and everyone got to see it.
Oh, that's
And kind
fantastic.
of to see themselves was something that we heard a lot of, that they it felt as though they were seeing something true.
There's this a theatrical release starting in Australia on the 19th of March.
Yes. Yeah, but a Q&A with me as well at the Classic in Elsternwick on the 14th of March, and Thornbury Picture House on the 22nd of March. So 14th of March and 22nd of March are special screenings that me and Ben and some of the crew will be at, if people want to come and hear more war stories. I shouldn't say war stories. It's not in these dark times. It would be great to have a turnout for those screenings. And there'll be others in Adelaide and Sydney, etc. But I think if you want to come and see the crew, then come on the 14th at the Classic and the 22nd at Thornbury Picture House. Iron Winter is worth seeing on the cinema screens.
And that was my chat with filmmaker Casimir Burgess. And as he said, just to reiterate, if you want to catch up with the filmmakers and see it on a big screen, go to the Classic, go to their website. It's on the 14th of March, and also the more intimate Thornbury Picture House on the 22nd. Coming up next is Published or Not, and we'll go out with Nico. I'll Be Your Mirror.
I be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door, to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Put down your hands, 'cause I see you. I find it hard to believe you don't know the beauty you are, but
you've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.